This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. We started the show today with a conversation about the U.S. Senate, but I want to turn now to the other chamber of our bicameral system, the House of Representatives. Last week, I had the opportunity to sit down and speak with Representative Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts' 7th Congressional District. Now, as part of our conversation, we discussed last week's voting rights speeches in Georgia, those that were given by Vice President Kamala Harris and President Joe Biden.
I'm glad that the president and the vice president made the case using the strength of the bully pulpit to restore voting rights and are taking action. You know, it's long overdue. Every option has got to be on the table, obviously, including eliminating the Jim Crow filibuster. These assaults have been unprecedented, and so we must meet the moment and move with urgency, the urgency that this moment demands. And for me, the most resonant parts of that speech was when the question was prompted, which side of history do you want to be on? And I know there were some for whom that did not resonate, but that point was deeply resonant to me. And the fact of the matter is that as we approached the national observance of Dr. King's birthday, he spoke about this filibuster and that it was obstructing justice, obstructing progress, and the fact that that is still true today. It's obstructed progress on meaningful gun violence reform, on immigration reform, on climate justice, on passing an anti-lynching act named for Emmett Till. You know, so I think the point here for me is that bipartisanship at this point is just an empty talking point. Bipartisanship is not the goal. Justice is the goal. And that's what we must keep in our sight line and remain squarely focused on. The most marginalized, mobilized, and delivered this Democratic majority. And being in the majority, having the House, the Senate, and the White House, that must be more than a talking point. We have a decisive mandate from the people, a responsibility and an obligation to meet the needs of that movement which elected this Democratic majority. And of course, we know that Black voters are targeted by this suppression. We know this is in direct response and a residual effect of the big lie that resulted in the insurrection on January 6th, which was a backlash to the strength of this movement comprised of majority Black and brown voters. So the filibuster, in my opinion, should not just be abolished for voting rights. It should be abolished outright. It has blocked progress on everything from voting rights to gun control to climate change to immigration reform. So a potential carve-out, it's a step in the right direction, but we cannot underestimate the ways that the filibuster will be used to block life-saving aid to our communities in the Build Back Better Act to do the work of the people. So the filibuster has got to go. It will obstruct also my legislation, the Women's Health Protection Act, to codify Roe v. Wade and to stop the ban, stop the introduction of harmful state bans like what we see in Mississippi and Texas. So we have to meet the urgency of this moment in the assault that is occurring, not only on voting rights, but for every other right.
You're a Democrat serving in the House of Representatives while, as you point out, there's a Democratic majority in the House, there's a Democrat in the White House, and there is something like a Democratic majority in the Senate. Is it feeling these days for you as a lawmaker like an exciting time when much is possible, or are you frustrated?
I think it's both and. You know, I'm incredibly emboldened by the strength of activists and advocates and everyday people who are weathering this storm and who have been on the front line of organizing and mobilizing in the midst of all of these assaults on our rights. So I'm an eternal optimist here. So I have to continue to practice that discipline of hope that I was referencing earlier. So I believe in the strength of the movement, but certainly there are days when I'm weary, especially when you see the obstruction of one lone senator from West Virginia who I believe is governing in a way that would lead us to believe that he has not compassion for everyone who calls his country home in this moment, but contempt. You know, his obstruction on the Build Back Better Act alone would deny millions of workers, families, and communities in my district and across the country life-saving resources and relief that they desperately need in this moment. West Virginia is one of the poorest states in the union. I think it's seventh in child poverty. So policies like the expanded child tax credit, these have helped countless families in the state, lifted children out of poverty. I often say, but more importantly, seek to practice the belief that the people closest to the pain should be the closest to the power, driving and informing the policy making. I don't cast a vote, write a bill, co-sponsor a bill without conferring with those closest to the pain. And Joe Manchin needs to talk to those closest to the pain. I'm sure they would like to see their senator work on their behalf. So, you know, I have moments where I'm weary in this fight, but for the most part, I maintain and practice a hope for what is possible. But again, being in the majority must mean more than a talking point. We have to meet the moment, and we have to lead in a way that is unprecedented, and we have to legislate in a way that is unprecedented. You know, especially in the midst of this quote-unquote reckoning on racial injustice, the only receipts that matter are policies and budgets.
I keep forgetting that that we did start a new year, and in this new start, perhaps we'll have an opportunity for things to be different. So let me start by asking you, I know that you just had COVID a few weeks ago, and I'm wondering how you're feeling.
Oh, I'm well. Thank you so much for asking. Fortunately, I was vaccinated and boosted, and so I'm fully recovered. Back at it.
I'm very glad to hear that. And I know it's kind of a time when, again, as we're sort of at the start of this new year, we're trying to think through what are the possibilities for what 2022 might be like. But it also means in the world of politics, it is officially an election year. Let me also then ask, how are the people of the 7th Congressional District of Massachusetts doing? How is your district faring in this moment?
Well, you know, I think unprecedented has been the word du jour for at least the last 3 years. And, you know, the Massachusetts 7th, like communities and districts across the country, is experiencing unprecedented hardship. And they have demonstrated the power and the resiliency of community, and that they have met that unprecedented hardship with unprecedented community, with unprecedented mutual aid, and with unprecedented hope, which they have had to have in the midst of these very challenging times. And, you know, I'm reminded of the words of a close friend of mine. It's something I say a lot and that I share with my constituents, the idea that hope is a discipline. It is a practice. And as the mantra goes here, offered by my dear sister friend, you know, I choose the discipline of hope over the ease of cynicism. And I choose fortitude over fatalism.
Now, sometimes the personal is political. And that's why Representative Presley and I talked about student loans. Let me just note that last Thursday, Navient, a major student loan collection company, agreed to cancel $1.7 billion in private student loan debt for more than 66,000 borrowers across 39 states. Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro said the company, quote, engaged in deceptive and abusive practices and targeted students who it knew would struggle to pay the loans back. Now, the loans that are going to be forgiven through this settlement are private loans, and it only affects those who have loans managed through Navient. But lawmakers, including Representative Presley, are pushing President Biden to end federal student loan debt for many students across the country. So I asked Presley about her fight to end student debt.
Student loans, this is a nearly $2 trillion crisis that is affecting people from every walk of life. Melissa, you're talking about your students, and many people characterize this issue strictly within the millennial and Gen Z context. But the fact of the matter is that It's affecting people from every walk of life. It is an intergenerational issue. The fastest constituency of student borrowers and debtors are 50 plus. I have 76-year-olds in my district who are still paying on student loans. We have seniors who have had their benefits garnished for defaulting on student loans. I have teachers in my district at the risk of losing licensure because they cannot afford the monthly minimums. I have parents who are still paying on their student debt and now absorbing the cost of their children's student debt. And then, of course, we have a whole generation of those who we are de-incentivizing to pursue higher education because they do not want to be in debt for the rest of their lives. This is choking at the promise of our communities. This is choking at the promise of this country. And there's something that can be done about it. A moment ago, we were speaking about fortitude. And I'm inspired by that fortitude that everyday people demonstrate every day. But this unprecedented moment we find ourselves in, where families are experiencing unprecedented hardship, which is including these student loans, we must match that with unprecedented leadership and legislating. And President Biden has the executive authority to cancel billions in student debt with the stroke of a pen. He was given that authority through the Higher Education Act by Congress. So canceling student debt, this will reduce the racial wealth gap. We know that 85% of Black students have no choice but to take out loans to pursue higher education because of discriminatory policies, what I would call policy violence, like redlining, which obstructed our families' abilities to build generational wealth. So 85% of Black students have no choice but to take out loans to pursue higher education. And then we are five times more likely to default. Women carry more than two-thirds of all student loan debt, and Black women in particular owe 20% more than their white peers. So you can save the accolades about the role that Black women play on the front lines in the fight for democracy, on the ballot and at the ballot box. Policy is my love language. This is a racial justice issue. So canceling student debt will help reduce the racial wealth gap. It'll jumpstart the economy. It will ensure that we have a equitable recovery from this pandemic-induced recession. And so my resolution with Senator Warren and Leader Schumer lays out exactly how President Biden can cancel student debt and finally make good on his campaign promise. And again, he doesn't need Congress to provide this sweeping relief to alleviate the burdens that our families are feeling. He was already granted that authority through the Higher Education Act. And might I add, since there's been much conjecture about does he have the authority, this is the same authority that the administration has used to extend the payment pause. And I thank the administration for heeding our calls. We organized, we mobilized, we fought for those pauses. And that has been game changing for families in the midst of this pandemic to have those monies to spend towards more critical things. And so instead of extending that payment pause one more time, he should just cancel student debt outright at $50,000. We've already, thanks to the strength of this movement, made strides on this issue. Momentum is on our side. The Biden administration has already canceled that debt for disabled student borrowers, for veterans, those victimized by for-profit colleges and universities, and for those participating in the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. So we're making strides, thanks to the strength of this movement, and we're closer than we've ever been before. And he must cancel student debt at $50,000. He has the authority. Like Nike said, just do it.
When I very first met you, it was at an event that you were hosting during the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation weekend, and you were launching the film Push Out by Monique Morris. And I know that in both 2019 and in 2021, you worked with other colleagues in the House to introduce that End School Push Out for Girls of Color bill. I'm wondering where that legislation is right now.
Melissa, thank you for taking me back to that moment. You know, talk about a moment where I felt hope. I'm getting emotional thinking about it. You know, as Black women, we were once Black girls and certainly know what it is to be criminalized simply for how we show up in the world. Our experience is very akin to this sort of unique dichotomy of being hyper visible and invisible at the same time. And when we brought together or had this convening during Congressional Black Caucus around my legislation, the End Push Out Act, to stop the criminalization of Black girls in our schools, alongside my thought partner in this work and my teacher as well, Dr. Monique Morris, the National Black Women's Justice Institute, and now of the Black Girl Freedom Fund, mm-hmm. I was so moved by how many people cared about Black girls. There were hundreds of people there. I think ours was the most well-attended or ranked high up there. And so that was an incredibly validating and affirming moment and emboldened us in this work. So far as the End Push Out Act, we continue to grow the list of co-sponsors for that. And, you know, I look forward to, as soon as possible, getting this before the Committee of Jurisdiction. I've been in consultation with the chair, Bobby Scott, about that, and hopefully getting it to the floor for a vote soon. So please do stay tuned on that, and thank you for taking me back to that day and that moment, and of course, for your solidarity on that issue and so many other issues of consequence to us.
It was a... It was just really one of those amazing moments where you just kind of kept looking around the room and seeing faces that you knew and didn't know, and you know, folks of great import that everyone in the room knew, and folks of great import who no one in the room knew. And it was really was also, I'll say, when you're in a room with hundreds of Black women, there's a lot of hair happening, lots of different kinds of hair, lots of beautiful hair doing all of the beautiful things that our hair does. And so I just wanted to ask you, because 2 years ago this week, in fact, you did something that is actually a rather stunning act of personal vulnerability, I think for anyone, but particularly for a sitting member of Congress, and particularly for a Black woman sitting member of Congress in a time of, we'll call it social media brutality. And you revealed that you'd been living with alopecia. And since then, you've mostly shown up in the world as a badass, bald Black woman. I'm wondering what you've learned as part of that experience over the past 2 years.
Yeah, so well, you're right, that anniversary is approaching. You know, I'm not sure people realize that I had not been living with alopecia for a long time. In a span of 5 weeks is when this occurred. And so what I'm living with now is alopecia totalis. There are several types of alopecia. I have alopecia totalis. And this is an autoimmune disease where your immune system attacks your hair follicles, and some 7 million Americans live with this. You know, I was so squarely focused on mourning my hair, mourning this relationship with my hair, mourning the community and the sisterhood of being in the salon, being at the beauty shop, mourning my progress in embracing my natural hair, and how authentic it felt for me to, even when folks thought it disruptive, to show up with a protective hairstyle in many of the rooms and spaces that I have been in as an elected official, that is what felt in the greatest alignment for me. And so I was in such deep mourning and so focused on the loss, I think I underestimated what I would gain. And I'm a work in progress, but I have gained an incredible alopecia community. I have gleaned new insights about myself, and, you know, ultimately self-acceptance. And so it was really the alopecia revealing was a moment of liberation for me, because I knew that I could not govern, lead authentically, feeling as if I was in costume. I was, you know, increasingly resentful of sort of one more piece of armor that I was having to put on in order to be socially acceptable, in order to navigate these spaces. Because, of course, how I show up as a bald Black woman is immediately disruptive. It challenges conventional and societal norms of what is professional, what is pretty, what is feminine. That's exactly why we had to introduce, and I'm one of the lead sponsors of the Crown Act, because, again, we are so often criminalized or experience punitive things, everything from not being promoted in a job or to losing a job or never being interviewed for a job, simply for how we wear our hair. So everything that I do as a woman, as a Black woman, as a Black woman who is elected official is political, including what sort of crown I'm rocking at the moment. So, you know, it has been a gift for all the ways in which I was grappling with a sense of loss. In many ways, it has been a gift. And I am blessed to, and my husband, Conan, have someone who reminds me in those moments when I feel plagued with self-doubt and don't feel beautiful, that I don't need hair to wear a crown. And so I'm grateful for that. And then finally, I would say that I've used my position as a lawmaker to advance this issue, stewarding my platform to raise awareness. I was able to secure some federal funds in our appropriations bill for more research on alopecia and other autoimmune diseases that disproportionately impact women of color. And I've introduced legislation with one of my colleagues, Congressman Jim McGovern, for medically durable wigs, which are very costly to be covered by insurance. Currently, that is not the case because many consider alopecia to be cosmetic and don't understand the psychological toll or the discrimination that many of us experience.
I'm struck by a particular intersection where you stand. I think about, you know, studying as a political scientist, kind of American Politics 101, that members of Congress who were African American for so much of the sort of initial experience of CBC members, Black members came from predominantly Black districts. That was so they could both represent national interests concerned with questions like racial health disparities, like the issues that you've been talking about with us. You are part of a relatively new generation of members of the Congressional Black Caucus who are elected from districts where you do not have a majority Black district, where you are simultaneously serving multiple interests, not necessarily countervailing interests, but both speaking to a national, even global Black community that wants you to see us, that sees you back, that is asking for you to address and press our issues, and responding to all of the concerns of the 7th Congressional District of Massachusetts, which is not a predominantly Black district. Do you feel yourself at a challenging intersection, or are those forms of representation for you intertwined? Are they one and the same?
Well, I certainly seek to advocate and to legislate in a way that is intersectional, because the everyday experience for people is that they do live in intersectionality. We do live in complexity and nuance. That has always been, as a voter, one of the things that has pained and outraged me is when elected officials would single issue a constituency, and they would, and they still do, come to Black folks and only talk about mass incarceration, come to the Hispanic or Latinx community and only talk about immigration reform, come to women and only talk about choice, come to the LGBTQ community and at that time only talk about marriage equality. But again, we live in nuance, and this is the way that I seek to legislate and to lead, because that's my lived experience. We don't live in these big checked boxes. So for me, it feels organic, although it feels organic because it's akin to my own lived experience, and I'm certainly no anomaly, but I do seek to be intentional in that way. So there is not, there isn't a pull for me. I've been a Black woman and at the intersection of these things for my whole life. And so it is not challenging. I will say about my district, I am the first person of color in the 230-year history of the Massachusetts delegation to be elected. And this seat was once held by John F. Kennedy. And a little known fact, Some know prior to being in Congress, I was on the city council for 8 years and aide in the Senate for 11 and worked for a member of Congress for 4 years. And I started in that office as an intern, an unpaid intern. I worked 3 paid jobs to do that internship. And that is the seat that I sit in today. I started as an intern for former Congressman Joseph P. Kennedy II, and he eventually hired me. And 25 plus years ago, I was a BU student and an unpaid intern in that office. And now I am the Congresswoman for the Massachusetts 7th Congressional District, which is a vibrant, diverse, dynamic district, Melissa, but one of the most unequal in the country. And so the district, just to offer this, is 53% people of color, actually, and 40% foreign-born, and almost 30% single-headed households. So this is the hardest-hit district by the pandemic, the most unequal district in our delegation, and one of the most unequal in the country. We're in a 3-mile radius from Cambridge to Roxbury, the blackest part of my district. Life expectancy drops by 30 years, and median household income by $50,000. I want to change the legacy of this district. And I say policy is my love language because these inequities and disparities and racial injustices are not naturally occurring. They're man-made. And so that's the work that I seek to do every day, and to do that in a way that is intersectional and that is bold and that is intentional and urgent.
Representative Ayanna Pressley of the Massachusetts 7th District. Not sure if you either just announced that you're running for president or maybe that your intern is running for Congress, but either way, I'll take it.
By the way, we pay our interns now. So, you know, and they make a living wage, you know. Shout out to all the interns running the country, honestly.
So. Representative Pressley, thank you so much for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.